Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Just a little over a week away from the much-anticipated and contested midterm elections, we'll talk about who votes, who doesn't, and why. Across the country, there are increasing reports of systematic attempts to restrict who votes through purges of voter rolls, stricter ID requirements, and cutbacks in early voting, which seem consistently aimed at disenfranchising communities of color. Even in places like California, where voter suppression is not typically considered a concern, our guests tonight point out to other barriers to voting that we'll be discussing for those whose first language is not English, or, for example, those who are disabled, or among younger voters, a general sense of disenfranchisement. So how can voters' rights advocates reverse these trends that we're seeing across the country? Well, we have three guests tonight to discuss these questions. Here in the studio, I'd like to welcome Lisa Garcia Bedoya. She's director of the Institute of Governmental Studies and Chancellor's Professor in the Graduate School of Education at UC Berkeley. She's written numerous articles and several books on the topic of voter engagement, including Latino Politics, Mobilizing Inclusion, Transforming the Electorate Through Get Out the Vote Campaigns, and Fluid Borders, Latino Power, Identity, and Politics in Los Angeles. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us from the studios of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, we have two guests. First is Mindy Romero, founder and director of the California Civic Engagement Project, which is now part of the University of Southern California's Sol Price School of Public Policy in Sacramento. Welcome, Mindy.
Good evening.
And finally, we're joined by Raul Macias, the Voting Rights Project Manager and attorney at the ACLU of Northern California. Raul was appointed by California Secretary of State Alex Padilla to the state's Language Accessibility Advisory Committee and the state's Voters' Choice Act Task Force. Welcome, Raul.
Hi, good evening.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. You can dial toll-free at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So I want to ask this question to each of you in turn. And I'll start with you here, Lisa, in the studio. How would you rate the state of ability to vote in our country at this state of time and politics and what we're going to unravel tonight in terms of factors that seem to be getting in the way of people voting? How would you describe how easy it is for people to vote? How does it vary by person, by part of the country? Just each of you in turn, just to get a sense of where we're starting from.
Well, just quickly, I think it's important to know that the United States is among the lowest in advanced industrialized countries in terms of voting rates. And I think there are many reasons for that. But we have to put the current situation within that broader context. We have always made it very difficult to vote. Comparatively speaking, other countries have Election Day as a holiday. They have elections that go over multiple days. They have other ways to facilitate the process. We've always had a very high bar. We require registration pretty far ahead of the election. We here in California, because of the initiative process, have ballots that are books filled with language that most humans don't normally understand. And we don't provide a tremendous amount of assistance or integrative work to help people who might, you know, maybe have lower levels of education or who aren't necessarily paying attention to politics, the facility to enter the system. So it's not by accident that our voting rates are so low, and they're especially low for people of color and people who are low income, people who move often, people who have multiple jobs, you know, the people who are really in precarious economic situations. And so I would say we're, on a scale of 1 to 10, probably a 4 in terms of access and the work that we do or the facility with which we help people enter the political system.
And what score would you give California specifically?
I think California is doing a little better than we are nationally. We've had a lot of really positive reforms over the last few years. I don't know, I think maybe I'd give California a 6 or a 7. The challenge in California is just that we are so big. The scale is so big, and we have so many immigrant origin voters, naturalized voters, people whose first language is not English. We have many low propensity voters. And so California has an extra need to make an effort to ensure that, in fact, the voice of the entire electorate and not just certain sectors of the electorate actually gets heard at the ballot box every election day.
All right. Mindy Romero, you go next. What's your sense of the state of voting in our country, and how does California compare?
Well, I would absolutely agree with the summary that Lisa just gave. We're not doing very well. And when you compare us against other established democracies, we are certainly not the beacon of democracy that many people think that we are, at least in terms of voting. You know, what Lisa described are what we call the institutional barriers around voting. We don't make it very easy for people to vote. And what California's been trying to do over the last number of years is making voting and registration more accessible, right? Trying to break down those barriers. The thing that I'll add to that is there's this other component. So I think of voting as there's kind of two main buckets or parts to this when we think about the problem we're trying to explain and address the low turnout. One is we need to make it easier for people to vote. That's the institutional side of things. And we also need to make people want to vote. And those are both related, very much so. But the want to vote, what falls in there is people feeling like their vote matters, people feeling motivated to participate, that if they take their time and their energy to actually physically go and vote or fill out that ballot and mail it in, to do the research, to responsibly, right, to be informed, that they think it actually makes a difference. And makes a difference not just in terms of the election and the outcome, like who wins, but makes a difference for themselves and their families, their communities. And a lot of Americans and a lot of Californians have a really difficult time seeing how voting is connected, really matters, and is connected to what they care about and to their life and to their life chances. And we don't do a very good job. There's lots of reasons for that, and I hope we talk more about that over the next hour. But we don't do a very good job of encouraging people to vote, aside from the institutional barriers. So we have we don't have an expectation of voting. It's completely socially acceptable to not vote in our society, particularly for our young people. And then you have this other component, this huge component, people, again, not feeling themselves, right, motivated and why it matters. And a lot of that gets labeled as apathy. And I think commonly when we think of apathy, we think, well, people just don't care. They don't give a darn. What's wrong with those young people today? Why aren't they participating? You know, why is there the sleeping giant? Why aren't Latinos voting more? All that kind of, all those labels that we put to people. And really, sure, there's always apathy in that true sense of not caring. But I would argue that almost everything we see is what might be labeled as apathy is, you know, there's real reasons why people are not participating, why they think their vote doesn't matter and they're feeling disconnected. And that's an area that we need to do more to address.
Great, and definitely want to talk about that intersection between the institutional barriers and the sense of lack of engagement and lack of a sense of ability to enact change through the vote. So, Raul Macias with the ACLU, I want to go to institutional barriers a little bit more in your comments around how we're doing as a country and as California in particular, especially since you've been pulled in to help with the issues of concern of unequal access to voting for some of our populations here in the state. Tell us your take about the institutional barriers to voting.
Well, in terms of thinking about how the country rates right now, I think we're at it seems that we keep reaching new low points. We've had, you know, 12 years ago, the country or our Congress renewed the Federal Voting Rights Act nearly unanimously. But since that time, there have been steady attacks around the country on voting rights. I think we're seeing, we're reading about it more and more in states all around the country, in particular since 2013, when the Supreme Court struck down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. It's allowed states that used to be under what's known as preclearance. So when they made changes, there was a burden on the states to show that their changes were not discriminatory against racial minorities. Since Section 4 was struck down, we've seen an increase in states that previously were covered by preclearance in passing laws, like you mentioned in the opening, voter ID laws, laws to end early voting. There have been increased registration requirements. So these kinds of things that that we think are discriminatory, and the ACLU has been filing lawsuits all around the state to try to fight these. But it's, you know, we can only be in so many places, and it really feels like we're headed in the wrong direction in a lot of places. I will say there are states, including California, where we are trying reforms that have the potential to register more voters and to make it easier for people to vote. In California, we've implemented automatic registration, which has led to the registration of hundreds of thousands of Californians already in just a few short months. And so there are reforms like that are being tried out in other states as well, and we hope to see more of.
And tell us a little bit more about your sense of how is it that when you look at different legislation that's enacted across the country, so Georgia or just not even legislation, it's just policy, purging of its voter rolls in North Carolina, making voter ID requirements much stricter. There seems to be a difference in how those different approaches are allowed to continue. Some are reversed because of court rulings. How do you make sense of that? That maybe there is a preponderance of this attempt to suppress voters voting, but then there are places where the same places that enact it can find ways to reverse it. How do you make sense of that, and how does that inform strategy in trying to understand a problem that, as you said, you can't be in 50 places to fix at all times?
Right. You know, in some of these places, the victories have been short won, that eventually they can be reversed by Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, and it would take legislative changes to permanently change some of these laws. So the court cases are important, but they're not necessarily permanent. What we're getting from those, and there's also just some of the things you've mentioned are things that might get more attention, but on smaller scales, there can be states that are or counties that are moving polling sites, you know, further outside of a city. They could be, or just closing them entirely. And sometimes those are, you know, there just aren't enough voting rights attorneys in every state to challenge those smaller changes, but that have an impact on voters.
So all three of you have given a pretty bleak picture of what the state of voting is like. Let's get into this a little bit more and talk about how, and this, Mindy, you said a little bit earlier, how the restrictions on voting and this lack of engagement amongst young voters and other groups kind of go together. Tell us kind of how those things work hand in hand, and help us understand why we shouldn't be looking at our youth as sort of apathetic, but instead somehow blocked or feeling impotent when it comes to exercising their right to vote.
Sure. And I think when we talk about it in terms of young people, I think it's even easier to understand that connection, the relationship between institutional barriers and, you know, the we think of attitudinal, but really it's, again, people feeling, right, not disconnected and looking for the impact of potentially voting and having a difficult time finding it. So I think with young people, you know, in our society, we expect kids to turn 18 and to magically both know how to vote, all the nuts and bolts around it, how to get registered, how to actually fill out a ballot, which is a complicated thing, particularly in our state, and also want to vote, right, to be motivated to vote, to see that connection. And one way that those are intertwined is if you're a young person and you've gone through school, and essentially we still have a pretty abysmal civics education system in the U.S., and California has been trying to do some things of late to change that, but still, you know, it's very lacking. And And so for most young people, particularly young people of color, low-income communities, they're not going to get they're not going to get a lot in school, and they're not going to get a lot outside of school. And if you're not being taught about the nuts and bolts of actually how to participate, right, how to fill out a registration form, how to feel comfortable in that process, how to get the information you need to actually vote. We hear all the time from young people, I'm not voting because I don't know how to vote. I don't know where to get the information. I don't want to make a mistake, right? Not apathy, but actually concern for doing the right thing. That also tells you, if you're not getting that, growing up and getting that through your schooling, and also not getting it from other institutions around you, that also sets a tone, right? And if maybe unspoken, understanding that your vote and your participation doesn't really matter if no one's showing you, or you're not getting a whole lot of right guidance and support in that. And then they turn 18, and again, we expect them to vote. And when they don't vote, we blame them for not participating, and we say it's apathetic youth. They don't care. Maybe it's a good thing that they aren't voting even then, if they don't care, and we should wait, or they should wait until they have more of a stake in the game. So young people aren't prepped. They aren't given that support. They're not given the larger support when they don't participate. They're not told, like, why aren't you participating? Social expectation is certainly not there for the most part. We sometimes give some lip service to it, but for the most part, it's not there. And I think together you end up having young people that care very much about their communities. It's not an apathetic generation at all. They're doing lots of different things in their communities. It's a volunteer generation, but they are not seeing how voting is an actionable step on something they care about. They may be volunteering, they may be joining organizations, they may be protesting in the streets. I do think, as of late, I should note that there have been, certainly, we've seen some examples of change, most notably in the national media around the Parkland shooting and the movement there around gun violence in schools. But overall, the trend has been for a very, very, very long time in our society that young people are not getting that support, they're not getting the nuts and bolts, and they're not encouraged and supported in other ways. And they end up entering into adulthood without those tools and without that encouragement. And what happens is some vote, but many, many don't vote. As they get older, some come back into the electorate or come into the electorate, right? As they age, more likely to vote. As you go up in income and educational attainment, more likely to vote. But it's not an equitable picture. It's not a representative group of young people, right? It's going to be those that are higher income in general, more educated, more likely to be white, and so forth. And we end up having, another reason why we have an electorate that's not representative of the population. And we have young people that are underrepresented and continue to be underrepresented through their life course. If they're from low-income backgrounds or of color, that's more likely to be the case for them. So I think that's probably, I'll leave it there just so I leave others time to talk about this too as well. But we're not setting that expectation, we're not giving them that support, and then we blame them when they don't participate. And adults, right, in our system at large, essentially is pretty apathetic to young people participating. Now, again, in California, there have been a number of recent reforms, like pre-registration, which is pretty exciting. We're seeing some really great numbers from that. And there are organizations, right, and other entities that are going into schools trying to get kids to pre-register, and so that's really promising. But overall, we're not doing what we could be or should be doing if we really want to see a representative young electorate.
So thanks, Mindy Romero, for that very comprehensive analysis of what is getting in the way of more youth engagement in voting. I wanted to pick up on something you said earlier in your comments and ask Lisa Garcia Bedoya of UC Berkeley to comment on this. You mentioned, Mindy, earlier on that there's this concern that there is not enough engagement among Latino voters, the so-called, as she referred to, sleeping giant, right? What's your take on what's the constellation of barriers here, institutional barriers, a sense of lack of engagement, or a sense of lack of ability to influence politics? If you kind of had to give us a broad overview, obviously the Latino population is quite diverse in and of itself, but...
Right. I mean, I think it's important to note that there are multiple Latino electorates, depending upon what state and what area you're talking about. But I think it's critical. There have been now a number of major news stories over the last week essentially saying that if there is not as big of a blue wave as people want, it's because Latino voters are still asleep. An image that I agree with Mindy, is offensive. And so I think we really have to remember this is a structural problem. So not only do you have low voting rates overall in the United States, you have systematic large disparities in voting across different communities. And we generally put the onus of that difference on the communities themselves and say they're pathological, they're apathetic, they just don't care, rather than thinking, well, what are the structural? So it is these institutional barriers, but it's also the fact that we simply don't talk to them. So if you add together, so most campaigns use these vote propensity scores in order to decide who to talk to during an election because they have limited money, they can't speak to every voter. And they usually only talk to people who score above 70. Essentially, if you're above 70, it means you're likely to turn out. I'm not going to waste my time if I talk to you. And if they get a bunch of extra money, maybe they'll go under, but usually those are the folks. If you add together those folks, plus the people for the midterm election, at least, plus the people who are unregistered among Latinos, it's basically 80% of the citizen voting age population among Latinos. So it's exactly the point that then they're not getting campaign information, they're not having anybody knock on their door, they're not having anybody call on the phone. And so if they are interested in the election, they have to go out on their own and find their own information and do the legwork themselves. And so it's not only that you're making it hard, so that's a barrier. You're sort of creating a higher bar to actually engage so that you can gather the information to do exactly what Mindy was talking about in my work with Latino voters, because they care so much about voting, they don't want to make a mistake. And so they need to get good information, and that's really difficult in the current information environment. But secondarily, it also means that they're getting the message that they don't matter, right? So it means candidates aren't talking about policies that they care about. So there's a whole ecosystem which makes very clear that this is not a space where I should spend my time and where I'm actually going to take care of the things that I care about. And so we have to appreciate that, you know, even in this current midterm, the Democratic Party has not spent the money that it should spend to reach out to Latino voters. So if Latino voters don't turn out, it's actually because the investments were not made. It's not because they are somehow pathological, detached, disengaged. In fact, if you talk to them, this is what I found in my work, if you knock on their doors, if you have a conversation with them about the things they care about, they will turn out to vote. The problem is no one's knocking.
And why is that, right? I mean, if Democrats are looking for a strategy to turn things around next week or in 2020, this keeps coming up, and yet it's not changing.
I blame what I call the political industrial complex, which is basically the consultancy class. So the people who run campaigns are, generally speaking, folks who are, if I can be frank, they're privileged white men, by and large. And they have a strategy that they've been using for the last 30 years, which is essentially to reach out to white, likely voters, and they try to flip the 3% of swing voters that they can flip to persuade to vote for their candidate. And that's what they say is a winning strategy. And if you think about all the postmortems that came out after 2016 and all the discussion of white working class voters, among the Democrats, there were three postmortems of about 35 that were done that actually talked about voters of color and what happened with voters of color. So you have this whole ecosystem of how we run campaigns that just doesn't see reaching out to voters of color as a winning strategy. And those are the people who decide how money is spent, and those are the people who decide. And the other, not to sound conspiratorial, issue is that if they buy ads, they get a percentage back. And so, you know, focusing on television, focusing on advertising actually makes them a whole heck of a lot of money. Putting canvassers into the field and having them talk to voters face-to-face doesn't. And so there are a lot of incentives to keep campaigns running the way they are that keep those strategies from changing.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about barriers to voting amongst voters in general, but especially communities of color here in California and across our country, just 1 week and a day away from the midterm elections. We have three guests, Mindy Romero, founder and director of the California Civic Engagement Project, and Raul Macias, voting rights project manager and attorney at the ACLU of Northern California, joining us by phone. And here in the studio, Lisa Garcia Bedoya, director of the Institute of Governmental Studies and chancellor's professor in the Graduate School of Education at UC Berkeley. We'll open our phone lines to you, our listeners, now to join our conversation. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at City Visions KALW. Mindy, did you want to say something there?
Oh, I was just going to add something. Yeah. Absolutely agree with everything that Lisa laid out there. The very related component to this is, so you've got, you do have this industrial complex. You have campaigns and candidates and their consultants using the likely voter model, and Latinos, and by the way, young people, to tie it back into our conversation about young people, aren't perceived as voters. The numbers, right, historically don't match that, and that's a big reason why young people aren't participating a lot, because they're also not getting that outreach and mobilization. But I wanted to add that beyond the strategy around campaigns, you know, when we're seeing news stories, we're looking at the overall aggregate numbers, your turnout numbers, right, at the state level, and we're comparing it over time, and we're saying, you know, these are not good numbers, or they're disappointing numbers, or they're okay numbers. And when we do see mobilization and outreach that is targeted, which doesn't happen very often, but when it is targeted, we have to remember that it is about what's best for the candidate or the campaign. And so even in this election right now, where there is some aggressive mobilization of people of color and young people, it's only where we, typically at least, where those candidates have deemed those groups could possibly strategically, right, be worthy of their investment and be a good return on their investment. And so aside from those political, right, those strategic campaigns, kind of almost everywhere else, we're not seeing a whole lot of engagement of young people or people of color, and often in the communities at large, right, if it's a safe district. And we have to just remember that those that are primarily responsible for that outreach and mobilization, those campaigns and candidates, those are the ones that have the, you know, do the bulk of the outreach and mobilization, are just being very, very strategic in who they're outreaching to, and often in very safe seats they're doing very little mobilization. And how could we then expect, right, realistically, when we talk about those news stories that say, you know, will the Latino vote, or will the youth vote, or, you know, whatever group we're talking about, will it be higher this year? We have to realize in a vast number of races, we're not even seeing necessarily any additional outreach or any additional funding that's coming in to do to mobilize those groups.
Well, it's
really an unfair and unrealistic expectation, and it does set up for the day after Election Day those narratives around failure.
Right. Quoting something that that you said earlier, Raul, you know, like the ACLU can't be everywhere, a candidate can't be everywhere, but it seems at the same time perhaps short-sighted to only go where you think you're going to be able to benefit from. Is that what you're saying? Like,
well, I'm not necessarily even blaming the candidates or the campaigns themselves, because they have obviously a strategic purpose and a singular goal in getting themselves, right, or their issue elected or winning. But it's just a recognition, if we're talking about expectations and we're talking about that narrative of failure, we have to understand kind of realistically how, you know, what that landscape looks like, and understand that in many of these districts there's really very little outreach mobilization period going on. Where it is happening, it's happening very strategically. It is based on often old models or misunderstandings, right, or misperceptions or even bias. And it just has these very real consequences. And we may on the surface, right, talk about, or in the media talk about, well, you know, all these factors should mean that we'd see, you know, all this turnout, right, for Latinos, for instance, right? But it comes down to, you know, local districts and local context often, and the set of outreach and mobilization that is happening or isn't happening. And we have to understand that you can be very motivated. There could be a lot of factors that logically should get out, or you hope would get out a group or an individual to vote. But everybody needs mobilization. Everybody needs that outreach. So you have the factors that are in play, but then they have to, in a sense, be activated, right? You have to be grabbed and pulled into the electorate. Right now, we leave groups, particularly historically underrepresented groups, on their own to, if they see factors that matter for them, we essentially, in many, many instances, are leaving them on their own to then say, okay, I'm going to vote and act on it. And they're not getting the outreach and mobilization that's so critical in our system to turn them into voters. And again, thinking about expectations, then we wonder why we don't see the turnout, and we blame, We bring groups themselves for why they're not turning out when they didn't get that activation, but other, you know, those that do fit the likely voter model did get that touch and that outreach.
So, Lisa,
does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Lisa, what's going to incentivize the strategies to change? And if it's not on the politicians to do it, then who?
Well, I think we're seeing, and I think the reality is we can't expect campaigns to do this work, right? Campaigns want to win. They need 50.1% of the vote. It doesn't matter if 100 people vote or 200 people vote, they still win, right? So you have a lot of organizations that are now systematically doing this kind of work, not only during electoral cycles, but between cycles. So folks like Win Justice, which is Planned Parenthood, Color of Change, the Center for Community Change, you have Sierra Club, you have other organizations, PICO, which is now Faith in Action, that do the systematic work. But what's important is that it can't just be one transactional conversation, I want your vote. It has to be, if you really want to change people's perception of their power within the system, you have to talk to them over time, you have to build a relationship with them, and you have to talk to them about the things that they care about. And so they have a different model of doing between cycle work. If you think about the Black Votes Matter is another group that was instrumental in making sure that Doug Jones got elected. They're in barbershops, they're having conversations in, you know, nail salons, things like that. And so I think if Gillum wins in Florida, and if Abrams, I mean, she may win, but I think at a minimum, you know, she's given Kemp a run for his money, and they have a very different strategy. I think the mindset that the only way you win is through white likely voters hopefully will begin to shift. And I think California is another example because the demographics of the state have made it so you actually do have to engage those voters and you do have to have a different kind of outreach strategy. And so I think that will slowly develop across the country, but it's going to take time and it's going to be, it's a real mental shift among the people who actually control the money in this country.
Raul Macias, I want to get you back in the conversation from the ACLU of Northern California because Lisa mentioned California, and there are two areas that you're involved in trying to increase the accessibility to voting here in California, specifically around language access and access for those who have disabilities. Tell us a little bit more about the genesis of that focus and what's being worked on.
Sure. So one of the things we've focused on at the state level and the local level has been the implementation of the National Voter Registration Act. There are two parts of that law we've done a lot of work on. One is the motor voter part, so making sure people have an opportunity to register to vote when they go to the DMV in an easy and convenient way. And then Section 7 of that law has to do with when Congress passed this law 25 years ago, they decided, well, they thought that not everyone necessarily goes to the DMV, and they wanted to make sure people if people are interacting with government in other ways, that they would get an opportunity to register to vote. So that could be people who are applying for public assistance or people with disabilities who are seeking services. And that law has been, well, across the country, compliance has been pretty spotty. There have been there are states that really don't do anything. They've just ignored this law for years. California, over the last 5 years, we've seen a big improvement over implementation. And so giving low-income people and people with disabilities more opportunities to register to vote when they're interacting with government. But we've recently filed a lawsuit to try to increase access even more. And so this would be for example, when students are applying for financial aid, making sure that they get an opportunity to register to vote, other offices that serve people with disabilities, making sure that they're offering voter registration. So trying to get the Secretary of State to designate more offices to provide voter registration. We also, regarding language access, we've been working with Asian Americans Advancing Justice on a case that has to do with language assistance when people go to vote, giving them access to what's called a facsimile ballot, so a copy of the ballot in their language that they can use in order to vote a real ballot. The Secretary of State's office is responsible for determining what languages are covered in California at a county level to provide, or actually down to the precinct level in providing these languages. We're arguing, and actually Lisa's helping us on this case to argue that this secretary really should have designated many, many more languages. We're covering about, I believe we're covering 17 languages right now, but we believe there's, the data shows we should be covering dozens more, dozens of languages.
Say more about that, because when I looked at the number of languages, I was like, wow, we cover quite a few. Why isn't that enough? And then the second part is, for those languages that we do cover, it sounds like what we are doing is not enough or isn't working. So say a little bit more about that, and I'll have Lisa join in as well.
Sure. So we are covering some languages. We think that the secretary, Secretary Padilla is actually covering more languages than other secretaries in California have covered in the past. But there's still languages across the state that where we could cover a lot more. In Los Angeles, for example, Arabic is a language we believe should be covered. There's something like 170 precincts that that meet the threshold that say we should cover that those precincts should offer facsimile ballots in Arabic, but the secretary declined to designate that language. And certainly, I don't think just providing these facsimile ballots is the end of the story, or that that's going to solve everything. But having those types of services available, I think, would be valuable to voters. It also sends a signal that they matter and that they should be, that they're welcome in these places. It would also, if the secretary designated these additional languages, it would also trigger other requirements, including the counties. Counties would have to recruit bilingual poll workers to assist voters in these additional languages. We have, you know, the most diverse state in the country, and I think we'd like to see us do more to lead in this area.
Lisa, do you want to add there?
I think it's important to appreciate that just because you speak a covered language doesn't necessarily mean you will have access to a facsimile ballot. That's the only addition. So if you are not in a jurisdiction that has been designated as covered, even if you have a covered language, if there aren't enough of you in that precinct, then you're not going to have access to a ballot in your language. And so I think, you know, even though on the practical standpoint, yes, it does cost money and resources and time to do this work, I think, again, the symbolic point that we should, in fact, make ballot access easy, and that it should be government's responsibility to actually keep that open, and flipping the idea that the onus is on the person, but rather on the government, and thinking about like what Oregon just did, where they've made voter registration automatic and you have to opt out rather than a voter having to opt in, right? I think it's flipping it and saying it's our job to make it as open as possible and to not kind of nitpick about, well, there are 150 Arabic speakers here, so that's not enough. But if there were 300, if you happen to live in a place where there were 300, then you would actually have access to a ballot in your language. That seems to me illogical. And so I think it is a matter of just of welcoming people and making sure people can make informed decisions about the policies and politics that are going to affect their lives.
Once again, I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about voter engagement and voter suppression with our guests, Mindy Romero of the California Civic Engagement Project, Lisa Garcia-Bedoya with UC Berkeley, and Raul Macias with the ACLU of Northern California. Again, our number to dial to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org, place a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So I wanted to read a few questions from an anonymous listener, a listener who wished to be anonymous. And this might give us a sense of perhaps why it's so hard to exercise the right to vote. What ID can and should voting officials require in order to get a provisional ballot? Is it standard to have a signature on the outside of the ballot? Could there be a downside to having voter name and address visible to anyone handling provisional ballots? I mean, there's a lot of technicalities here, right? And if you recently move, can you still use the ballot sent to your former address? So there's lots of technical pieces to voting. How much of that is also part of this problem, Lisa or Mindy, when you're trying to get people whose language is first language is not English, or who are voting perhaps as the first time when they turn 18. How much is besides not getting it right, meaning worried that they're not going to vote correctly in the sense that they'll mess up the ballot, that they somehow think like, wow, this is just way too complicated to figure out.
I think that's the reality. It's a very intimidating process. Many people don't know that they can vote for the top of the ticket and not vote the bottom of the ticket. Can I skip the judges, right? The judges are always the ones you can never get information on. I actually had to vote a provisional ballot because my polling place changed because I wasn't paying attention this last election. And as someone that works in this area, it still felt very kind of dicey. Like, is this actually going to count? And so appreciating the lack of basic information, what does the machine look like? How do I fill out the form? Can I take my sample ballot in to remind myself what I've decided I'm going to vote on? Can I bring my child with me? Because actually you can in the state of California. Many people don't know that. So I think just appreciating it feels very official. It feels very important. It feels like you could very easily make a mistake, and that is really intimidating for many people. And that if we got rid of that sense of intimidation, we actually would probably have many more people participate in the process.
Mindy?
I agree. We probably should say that your provisional ballot will, in all likelihood, get counted so people can trust in the system. But that intimidation factor does really matter. And I think what I'll add to that is, you know, often when we're a research center, but we do a lot of outreach in the sense that we talk about our research and the research in the field. And as we're out and about doing that, we do get a lot of questions from people that say, I don't get it. I don't understand why voter turnout is low. I don't understand why young people or other groups, right, are participating in lower rates. Why is it so hard? It's really, taking it along the lines of blaming the victim, but a little bit more to that, right, saying we don't really need to do anything else because it's already pretty simple. What's so hard? And it is, if you're unfamiliar with the process. So most of the people that are saying it doesn't seem so hard, what's the big deal, are people that are probably diehard voters that vote every time. And even then, as Lisa just said, you can still have those moments where you are uncertain. But if you've not voted very regularly or you've never voted before, it's your very first time, it can be incredibly intimidating. And it can be a barrier for why people don't participate. You know, why they, if they don't feel they have enough information and they don't know about the judges, it's always the judges, that maybe then they don't fill out that vote-by-mail ballot because they literally think they have to submit everything and they're trying to actually be responsible in that process. So I think remembering that and remembering when we hear the criticism sometimes of why people aren't voting, it's very easy, if you're very comfortable with it, to not get it why it's not so, right, not such a no-brainer for many, many other people. We make it harder, right, for people also to get that information if they're unfamiliar with it. The last few years have been a number of avenues now that you can go to Voters Edge, League of Women Voters. There's lots of different places you can get information on candidates. Judges are still hard. You can go to the Secretary of State's office at the website and identify whether your vote by mail ballot was actually counted. Yes, you do have to sign your ballot envelope. Signature does need to match the signature that's on file. But there is information available. But again, many voters don't know where to go and that information is available. So that's also a barrier.
Thanks for answering the questions of the listener there. Yes, go ahead, Raul.
Well, just to, for that particular listener, if they have questions, they can also always call 866-OUR-VOTE. It's an election protection hotline that can answer some of these questions. I think some of these they can also just direct to their county elections official. Some of these sound specific to their situation. But 866-OUR-VOTE is a election protection hotline that that voters can call.
Okay. And what languages if they have questions are available?
You know, I think they have a number of languages available in terms of staff, but I believe there's also they use a translation hotline if people are calling in a language that they don't have someone who speaks that language.
One group we haven't talked about, but if we think about this issue of trying to engage and remove institutional barriers among communities of color, are convicted felons. We've been talking at various points about the overrepresentation in the prison population of people who are convicted of felonies. Is there any work being done in the organizations that you represent or that you know of that really is looking at that issue? Because that could be definitely seen as a pretty large institutional barrier. Anyone?
I can speak a little to this. ACLU here in California, we've worked on this for decades. We have a website that people can go to for information. There's an area that there's a lot of confusion about who's eligible to vote. I think people hear news from other states and they get confused about who is actually eligible to vote. But in general, unless you're serving a federal or state prison sentence or unless you're on parole for the conviction of a felony, you're eligible to vote in California. We have a website, letmevoteca.org, that people can visit for more information, or they can also call the election protection hotline or their county elections official. Here in California, we passed a law a couple of years ago to make it even more clear that it's only people who are serving parole for the conviction of a felony or in state or federal prison who can't vote. So if you're in county jail in general, you can vote. If you're on probation, you can vote. If you're convicted of a misdemeanor, you can vote. If you're awaiting trial, you can vote. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people who are still ineligible because of either because they're on parole or in prison. But what happens, too frequently, I think, is that people unfortunately believe that they're ineligible to vote because they had a conviction at some time in their life and think that they can never register to vote again. And that's not right. And I appreciate you asking that question.
And just any work in trying to reverse the restrictions on those serving time, whether in custody or on parole, or is that just kind of like a non-starter?
Well, yes, there are organizations who are working on this. There's a great organization called Initiate Justice that tried to qualify a ballot measure for November. They came up short, but I know they're going to continue to work on this. We in California, to go any further, we would need a constitutional amendment unless our governor took some action sort of unilaterally. This is what they did in New York, where Governor Cuomo issued essentially what are partial pardons to people on parole to restore their voting rights. And so that's another avenue that we could take in California.
Lisa, you wanted to say something there.
I just wanted to lift up what Raul mentioned in terms of the misinformation. We did a study back in 2015 looking at the reasons people give for not registering to vote, and a pretty significant proportion of people say that they're not eligible, people who've already said they're 18 and citizens. And so I think it's not only people who have a conviction, but I think sometimes people who've had any interaction with the criminal justice system believe that has made them ineligible. And so that misinformation disenfranchises many people beyond just the actual incarcerated or formerly incarcerated population.
So lots there to turn around in terms of people's perceptions of their right to vote. Mm. So, Mindy, there was something that Lisa said earlier about the what do you call them, facsimile ballots? Is that right? Is that a strategy being thought about in schools to try to get even maybe kids who can't vote or aren't of voting age and maybe the couple of years beforehand to kind of just get in the practice or the habit of doing it? When is too early to start on voter education?
Oh, it's never too early to start. Actually, I alluded to really briefly that there have been some changes in California recently. There's a momentum happening around civics education through a group called the Power of Democracy, which was started and supported by the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, and I believe with support from the State Superintendent of Schools. And they actually, through a task force that they created, produced a report called K-12 Civic Learning, really encouraging and trying to make the case for starting in kindergarten in some form, talking about and integrating the importance of civics through lesson plans, through the curriculum. It shouldn't be certainly what it is right now, which is one semester in your senior year, your government class in California. And it shouldn't just be high school. So one big tool, which we mentioned earlier that schools now have and those that work with young people have, is the pre-registration. So as folks come into schools, right, organizations, League of Women Voters, other great groups, want to talk to kids about voting, want to register kids or talk about the importance of registering, they can actually pre-register 16 and 17-year-olds. So that's pretty exciting. But it shouldn't be just then. We need to establish establishing that norm around voting and that cultural expectation of voting and that support of young people, right, is we should be doing it at much younger ages. So I'll leave it there.
So I just wanted my producers feeding me some information about accessibility to voting. This is specific to San Francisco, the city and county of San Francisco. But for those of you who might have missed the October 22nd registration deadline for voting, you can still visit a voting center to register to vote conditionally and cast a provisional ballot. So it's not all lost. And then the way it works is once again, we're talking about San Francisco here. The Department of Elections processes the affidavit of registration, and determines that one is eligible to register. The registration becomes permanent, and the provisional ballot will become counted. So it's not like you have to go back and do it again.
We can add to that.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Since you specified San Francisco, and Raul, I'm sure Lisa could speak to this too, but starting as of last year, we have conditional voter registration, which I think is what you're talking about, every county in our state. We have our deadline, which this year was October 22nd. People hear that deadline, they think it's too late, and it used to always be too late to register. And now, after the deadline, you can conditionally register any day up until election day. If it's in a non-VCA county, so there's five counties in the state that have adopted the Voters' Choice Act.
Say more about what the Voters' Choice Act.
Yeah, I was going to say the one in the Bay Area that has adopted the Voters' Choice Act is San Mateo. So just for your listeners, pardon?
In Napa.
Oh, well, Napa, yes. Napa is part of the extended Bay Area. Thank you, Raul. Voters' Choice Act, there's a lot there to it. If you're an adoptee county, you means that you're sending a vote-by-mail ballot to every registered voter. That registered voter has some choices what they can do with that ballot. They can mail it in if they've always mailed in their ballot. They do it like they always have. They can drop it off at a designated drop box across the county. They can drop it off at what we call now vote centers. Or they can still choose to vote in person at a vote center. Neighborhood polling places now have been moved and changed to vote centers. They're open up to 11 days, some of them up to 11 days, 10 days before Election Day, 11 days total. We call it more ways, more days. But I don't want to confuse folks in your listening area either, because most of the counties in the Bay Area and most of the counties in the state are still our typical traditional voting system with traditional polling places. And if it's a traditional polling place system, then you can, if there are early voting centers, some counties have that, you can conditionally register an early voting center, but you can definitely register conditionally at your registrar's office up until Election Day. And that will allow you to be able to vote. And yes, it has to be verified later, of course. And if everything's in order, then that vote counts. If you're in a VCA county, you have more options. You can go to any vote center up and through Election Day and both conditionally register to vote and vote.
And so
there's a lot of details to that new system that I have omitted because of time.
Right. And what's the expansion plan here? Is it really on the counties to decide they're going to do this?
It is. I mean, certainly with a lot of encouragement, I think, by our Secretary of State's office and other groups that have been that helped kind of champion the law coming into existence. But right now, the law SB 450 allowed for 14 counties in 2018 potentially to adopt. Five actually decided to adopt in 2018. Starting in 2020, everyone else can adopt, and it's up to those counties to do so if they want to, and we understand there are a number of counties that are considering adopting. So we'll have to see, and eventually, beyond 2020, certainly other counties can choose to adopt as well.
One other thing that I wanted to point out is that non-citizen San Francisco residents can vote in the Board of Education election, which is probably not something a lot of people know, huh? I was sort of reading and I was making sure there wasn't a typo there. But I mean, I'd heard it before, but I didn't remember. And for non-citizen San Francisco residents, conditional voter registration is also still an option if you missed the registration deadline. Yeah, Lisa. Yeah.
Well, I just want to say it's a fairly new change. That's part of probably why you didn't know. But I think it's important to point out this is part of the complexity. We have 58 different voting systems in the state of California. Every county does what they want, how they want, when they want. And so if you move from one county to another, even that can actually make it much more complicated in terms of figuring out how it works in that county versus another county. So just appreciating the complexity of our federal system.
So we have just a couple of minutes left in the program. I just wanted to have each of you, if you had your wish list of the top one or two things you would want to see happen to really turn the tide on decreasing institutional barriers to voting, especially among communities of color, and raise that sense of engagement and empowerment amongst those same communities and youth, as we've been talking about. What would those be? Let's start with you, Raul Macias.
Well, the reform that you brought up and that Minnie was talking about, conditional voter registration, is something that the states that have widespread access to what is commonly known as same day registration or election day registration, where people can register and vote on the same day up to election day, is the states that have this reform are amongst the highest turnout states in the country. We still have 6 million unregistered voters in California, more than 6 million unregistered voters. Registration is still maybe the biggest institutional barrier for a lot of people. It's the first step they have to take, and a lot of if we had widespread access to same-day registration, that's what I'd like to see California adopt. And whether that's through the vote center model or for counties who don't go that route and are keeping their polling sites, I'd like to see same-day registration be available at every polling site.
Mindy Romero.
Well, there's a lot of things. Since we're talking a lot about young people tonight, I'll say that certainly more work with young people, kind of baked in, for lack of a way of saying it, into our schools, an equitable distribution of our civics education, more civics education and an equitable civics education system. I neglected to say earlier, but when we were talking about things that happen that we can be doing in schools that help prepare young people. There is a lot of research that shows that things like, mock elections and debates and all of those sorts of things help prepare young people, that they're more likely, if they engage in those efforts, to both register and turn out to vote when they turn 18, and more likely to continue to vote right through the life course. So I think the more we can do with our young work we can do with our young people, and it can't be just schools. It has to be beyond just that institution. Schools can't do it all, and the gap is so large. So we have to remember that as well, and we have to give schools the support, both in terms of dollars, but in terms of our wider society. And I think we can, particularly, there's a potential there for, if it is equitable, to see a young electorate that is more representative of California, and then over time, hopefully, as they age, an electorate that's more representative of California. So that's one thing that's
okay
on my mind.
And I want to make sure Lisa Garcia Bedoya gets in her voice in here too. What do you see changing that's going to really change the landscape of who's voting, especially in communities of color and Latino communities?
I think actively trying to build a participatory culture, which starts with what Mindy was talking about, civic education, but not just civic education, a civic education that's problem-based, that really teaches them about how to access the system and how to use the system to address the things they care about. An immigrant integration policy, the lowest participation rates in California are the immigrant origin communities. We should actually bring people in instead of expecting people to figure out on their own, and then they're going to integrate their children, and that is then going to affect the socialization in their networks. And so having a proactive policy where we automatically register people, like Oregon did, I think is a place to start, but it's a multifaceted program that we have to put together.
A collective responsibility instead of a voter's responsibility.
Correct.
A single voter's responsibility. Well, I want to thank our guests for joining me this evening. Mindy Romero, founder and director of the California Civic Engagement Project. Lisa Garcia-Bedoya, director of the Institute of Governmental Studies and Chancellor's Professor in the Graduate School of Education at UC Berkeley. And Raul Macias, voting rights project manager and attorney at the ACLU of Northern California. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulip. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper, and we want to thank our friends at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento for the use of their studios tonight. Join us next time when we wrap it all up just before Election Day next Monday. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.